Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
September 3rd, 2017, episode 114, Winter is Coming. Greetings, one and all. Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast. Kevin England here after our little summer break. I always get a little squeamish about taking a break this time of year. It seems that there's been a pattern the last few summers that this time period becomes a lull simply because life gets in the way. I had every intention of avoiding that this year, but, well, work and my professional life has thrown me a curve that I didn't see coming, so there's that, and that's all I need to say on that not-so-pleasant topic. Many of you will hear the phrase, and it will bring different meanings to it. Winter is coming. The title of this episode is a subtext to some things happening in life. Life changes and seasons move on. And without belaboring the point or delving into alternate meanings, I'll focus on the theme of this episode, that is, literal, winter is coming. As August comes to a close, I get into winter mode. September and October bring the 2 months to make winter bees. And in this episode, I'll be exploring my game plan to get to winter and overviewing my activities. If for what it's worth, I haven't been recording because I've been away. First EAS, and then we chose to return to Seattle this year for our family vacation to see our son Danny and his girlfriend Katie. While away, I try to be low-key about announcing my exit even though we have someone looking after the house while we're gone. Similar to refraining about posting your whereabouts on Facebook, why invite temptation? So a little discretion makes sense. While out in Seattle, I found a little excursion to the West Seattle Bee Garden and had a short sit-down with a local honey producer there. I'll bring you what they had to say a little later in the episode. I shared in the most recent episode that I was taking the Master Beekeeper's exam at EAS, and I ended up with mixed results, but positive results, as far as I see it. I passed 2 of the 4 exams, and I'll talk about the experience and share a little insight onto how it went and plans for the future. I have a few other topics to cover in no particular order. We got quite a square. Did I do it again? Kevin moment. Blooper. I'm recording this, and I just have a bullet list of notes. And I've tried to record this statement, we've got quite a scare, 3 times, and I've said we've got quite a square 3 times. I don't usually edit these things. I try to let them roll even with a little faux pas here and there, but this one, yeah. End of Kevin moment. We got quite a scare in New Jersey as the New Jersey Department of Agriculture posted a draft of beekeeping legislation that sent anyone who saw it scratching their head in a moment of what were they thinking. I'll talk about what it is and what it was and where it was. I'm not going to dwell in the past, but I'll just kind of cover it. I have a few garage projects going on and off. I ordered some new hive stands from Man Lake, for example, and I'll talk about first impressions of that stuff. We recently wrapped up fair season for the summer. I know, talking about fair is not very exciting. However, I'll share some quick impressions and talk about a collaboration between myself and Tim Schuler for honey judging. While at EAS, I picked up some new equipment. I'll cover the bounty and talk about what I brought home. As for the rest of it, well, today is a bit of making it up as I go. I have a few other topics on the pile, and I suppose I'll squeeze in a few of the round table topics if I can. Or I'll reserve them for next time if we're starting to go long. With a couple of interviews in here, not sure about that. I'm ready to get started, but a quick note on the local hive report. I wanted to give a sense of an operation with 15 hives for a hobbyist. I don't plan on doing this all the time, but today I'm going to do a roll call and fill you in on where they stand. I said it's a lot of work for a person who works for a living to host 15 hives, and perhaps when I'm done, you'll get a sense of what I mean. I wonder if, when they are all built out, it will equate to maintenance versus management in the operation, but it still seems like a lot of work in the future, meaning I can envision what it'll take to maintain these hives, and I guess time will tell. So agenda done to the local hive report. For this local hive report, I'm going to kind of walk the yard and give an impression of each of the hives, what they are, what has happened with them recently, and any impressions since we last spoke. My intention is to make this a hybrid topic and a local hive report, as I want to talk somewhat about the aspects of winter planning as I see it this time of year. Before I start, I'll share that with 15 hives, I have come to question how I manage them as a principle of tracking a hive as an entity. I've always tracked my hives by the hive, on the hive stand, where the hive was located in the yard. Lately, having made splits and nukes, this practice has become unruly. What I mean by this is, how do I identify them? I have always had kind of nicknames for each of my hives. But now that I have 15 of them, I can't keep track of them. So I was thinking about a way to mark them in a way that does one of two things. There's an aspect of a hive that it should be kept as an entity or tracked as an entity for its entire lifespan. If the colony succumbs over winter, for example, then the next use should be tracked as a new thing, if that makes any sense. I'd never done it that way, but in my new way of thinking, I'm going to start. So here's my new game plan. I'm going to take a washer, you know, like nut bolt washer. I think I'm going to use one of those large fender washers with a small hole. And I'm going to screw it to the bottom board of my box, or maybe somewhere else on the hive. I'm not sure yet. Could be to the roof. It could be to the lower box. I don't know. And to that, I'm going to attach a magnetic sticker, like one you would put on your refrigerator with a number on it. So I happen to have roll sheeting of magnetic material for when I used to make truck magnets when I was in the sign business. I'm thinking I'm going to cut out 15 squares, number them 1 to 15, and stick them on each one of my hives, and then use my hive inspection tracking sheets and make it a note by the hive number from now on. So there's an idea that goes along with this new numbering scheme is that the numbers will go up forever. If, for example, hive number 4 doesn't make it through the winter, I do not plan to reuse that number ever again. I'm going to go to hive number 16. That's what I'm thinking, and I'm not sure if I'm going to stick to it. I'm still debating. The reason I'm on this line of thought is I always wondered at some point how many hives I've actually had in my time. My guess is I could probably go back and track through this podcast and figure that out by listening to my local hive reports. It's an interesting notion, but then again, who has time to go back and do all that stuff? And I have an archive of photos and things that I've done from even from the beginning, as you know me. I guess all I do is start my hive numbering 1 through 15. If I lose a hive, then I'll make a judgment then. I think I always have little pet names for some of my hive descriptions. The box made from cedar will always be the cedar hive for me. The polystyrene hive will always be polystyrene. I think it's just common sense that you'll come up with pet names, so to speak. So, how the hives look, let's go through them. Hive 1, pad 1, it's a 2-deep Langstroth box with a medium on it. The hive started out as a nuke and was about a box and a half the last time I looked at it, and I'm feeding it. The reason it had a medium on it is because I harvested honey and I took that medium and threw it on there for them to clean it out just before I left for vacations, and I didn't have a chance to take it off. My guess is the bees aren't doing much with it, and this afternoon, when I go out to work the bees, I'm just going to pull that box off and return it back to the garage. Hive 2, pad 2, is the 3-deep gateway hive that's sitting on the scale. There's a pet name. One of the boxes is painted like a cow. This is the hive that was loaded with mites and is currently being treated with Apivar. Kevin moment. I should note that every single hive has a feeder on it right now so that I have the option to feed it if I find that it's light. I did that before I left, and as I do my inspections through September and October, a hive feeder sitting on it does no harm, but if they need to be fed, I don't have to check it out at the time. So it was just a management approach that I chose this year, which I've never done before. End of Kevin moment. Hive 3 is an anomaly. Started out as a nuke. I added a shallow of a nuke box to it, so it was a nuke in a shallow nuke box. The hive was growing so fast, and I didn't have a full-size nuke box to put on it, but I did have some spare shallow nuke boxes. Now, since I've done some arrangements, I have another full-size nuke, and I put that on top of it. So the configuration is a nuke, a shallow, and a full-size nuke. And I think I'm going to leave it this way. I know it's an odd configuration, but I'm going to overwinter it in this configuration, and more on that in a second. To be clear, if I'm confusing you, when I say a nuke, it's a full-size, five-frame deep nuke, and then a shallow, and then a full five-size, full nuke, full height. Hive 5 is... Oh, I missed one. Hive 4, I'm working by notes, can you tell? Hive 4 is a double deep 8-frame box. This hive started out in the early spring as a split taken from the gateway hive and has built itself into 2 full boxes at this point. Looking good. Hive 5 is a relative to hive number 3. It is also, ding, a full nuke, a shallow, and a nuke. My intent is to combine 3 and 5 together side by side on a stand over winter in a nuke condo, but just these two right now. You know, as I think about it, I haven't physically numbered these hives. I'm going to do that this afternoon. Maybe I'll switch hive 4 and 5. So 3 and 4, which are cousins, can sit next to each other in the number list. Yeah. That was a Kevin moment. Hive 6, I've started this as a nuke. And it was the one that was extremely aggressive that I spoke about in the previous episode. I've come to believe that that hive was queenless at the time, and just before I left for Seattle, I checked, and this hive made itself a new queen, and the demeanor had changed completely. Weird, right? I don't know why it requeened itself, but it was nasty because it was queenless, and all of a sudden now it's all better, no problem. I'm going to keep an eye on the temperament because the previous hive, well, it's probably because they're queenless, not because they were bad genetics. So given that it was without a queen, it's still only in one box. I think by this time it's probably full built out box, and I have a new box with foundation to put on it, and I'm going to feed the snot out of it for the rest of the year and see if I can get it to 2 full boxes. If not, I might retract it to a nuke and put it in the condo stack, but we'll see where it takes us. Hive 7, this box started out as another nuke, and it has built itself out to 2 full boxes. It is very happy and good to go. All of the boxes thus far are in what I call yard number 1. They're in the original hive location where I've kept my hives over the last couple seasons. Hive number 8 is the same story as hive number 7, 2 deeps, and it's good to go. With hive number 8, I'm now further down the line in my property along the other end, the other corner where I keep my bees, the new place where I've made places to keep bees. Hive number 9 started as a nuke and is only one box and is a bit of a runt. I haven't made up my mind what to do with it yet. Hive number 10 is a polystyrene hive. It's 2 deeps and 2 mediums, and it's doing pretty well. This is one that overwintered. It's got an Apivar treatment on it right now. Hive number 11 is a 2015 package hive. It's a single deep with 3 medium boxes over that. This is the one that I did the walkaway split. It has since recovered And it too needed a mite treatment, so it has Apivar on it. It's a strong hive, and I think has fully recovered, even though I made a split of it earlier. I should note that I have been feeding it a little bit, too, to prop it up some. Hive 12 is the split from the 2015 package. It's amazing. It has two deeps, two mediums. It has grown, surprisingly, into a full-size colony in short order, and this thing is just hauling the mail. Give bees a new home, they'll find lots of opportunity, it seems. Hive 13 is a spring nuke that is now in a three nuke box tower. In essence, if you think about it, it's 15 bees, 15 frames, and it's a box and a half. You'll hear me say I'm building boxes for it. I'm about to move it into two deeps so I can finish it off and have it two deeps for winter. Hive 14 was also a spring nuke. It's currently in one deep and a one medium because it should have been two deeps, but I ran out of boxes. That's why I'm building equipment in the garage. It was bursting with bees in one box before I left for vacation, and I had no choice but to put a medium on it because I had a bunch of spares, and I didn't want it to swarm before I left. Hive 15, my last and final hive, is the Waray hive. Given the dimensions of the box, it's a little bit smaller than a Langstroth. It's an 8-frame hive. Of the 16 frames that are in the two boxes I have on it right now, 15 are built out. My plan is to give it a hive top feeder for the hive so I can get more food on board quicker. I've been feeding it with a Boardman feeder. It's just not enough delivery of food fast enough for growth. It's ready for the third box. And I think in order for them to have enough food to finish the third box before October 31st, I need to feed them more. Overall, I'm pretty happy with this box. It built out well, and it's ready for a third box. I hope I can get the full third box on so that it has enough bees and resources to overwinter. I don't know whether this box will make it with two boxes. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think it probably needs all three to get there. So more on that again later in the episode. So winter is coming. I said I was going to go to blend the local hive report with that topic. So let's talk about winter is coming. Local hive report, check. Topic number one, winter is coming. Each one of my boxes, with the exception of the full colonies that I started out with this year, have some work to do. Some of them have had some frames recently added to them, so they're not completely built out. Some of them, as I've stated, need more space and equipment. So between today and October 31st, I always use Halloween as a benchmark. How does that work for you in your area? I'll be working on getting these hives to full song for winter. To me, it's always about September and October. So September 1st to October 31st is 61 days, or in translation, three brood cycles before cold sets in. Although, truth be told, it's been a really cool summer here in New Jersey. I mean, last night it was 50-something degrees. My guess is the bees might be clustered. That's unusual. I mean, usually in August, the end of August, I could remember it being 80, 90 degrees. We're literally ready to button up the pool. A lot of people close their pool on Labor Day, more for the leaves. And I remember closing the pool on Labor Day and it being hot afterwards and wishing the pool was open. Not this year. Heck, we're not in it at all. It's too cold. All right, back to topic. I need all these bees to be all they can be. That means my colonies need to be disease-free, queen right, and have the right number of bees, and of course have ample food stores for over winter. I need to keep monitoring my mites. I did mite checks. I've treated. And when I'm done, I need to check and see that the treatments were effective. As I think about it, to me, the most important thing is the right number of bees in stores. And I'd never take advantage of this, but I hear people do it all the time. And this year, I think I'm going to try it. It's equalizing your hives. If you have a really strong hive with excess resources and one that's just kind of needs a little prop up, I might do some swap this year. I don't know, thinking about that. And then, of course, my plan to put my nucleus colonies together in a new condo, I need to get the equipment ready for that, the insulation and where I'm going to put them in. And you have to think of the steps that get you to the final thing in October 31st. That's where my brain is, literally today, as I go into Labor Day weekend. I said a few minutes ago that I needed more equipment. While I was away, I ordered equipment, and I'm currently assembling and painting a number of hive boxes. I ordered 40 frames with foundation. Stupid me, I didn't order them built. I swore I would never do that again, but I ordered them, and I have to build them. I should note that I deployed all of my Kelly F-frames, almost all of them. By the way, a Kelly F-frame is a frame that has a wedge frame and does not require foundation, for those that are not familiar with them. I place these in between drawn comb and a lot of the hives that are building it out. I'm hoping to switch to foundationless for the long term. That's what a Kelly F-frame does. They build it all the way down and there's no foundation in it. This is brood chamber stuff and I don't intend to spin it out from honey ever. And I want to get foundation out of my hives. I'm just kind of thinking that they can build the cell size whatever they want and things like that. Little treatment-free, more natural approach is where I'm heading there. But I do believe that in order to just keep expanding, I need to put some foundation comb and replace some of my older comb. And I just can't put all Kelly F-frames in. They'll build wonky comb all over the place. So it's a step forward, step back, step forward, step back. Put foundation frame in, let them build them. Rotate the old foundation frames out. In the meantime, put foundationless in between them. And eventually the operation gets to foundationless for the long term. Get it? I think that's kind of what I was trying to sum up. It takes patience, grasshopper. But I'm in it for the long run. As I talk about this, though, I have a concern, Kevin moment. My hives aren't really very level. And I'm probably getting myself in trouble by putting these Kelly F-frames in hives. And I'm not going to result in good comb. But it was in such a haste prior to vacation that I simply just stuck these frames in without checking the level of my hives. And I'm going to get what I get. You see, it cleared that one area in area two, and I dug it all out, and I leveled it all out, and I put mats down and things for the hives, but it rained, and it settled, and where I dug, I went out and looked at my hives the other day. Some of them look like the Leaning Tower of Pizza, and I put Kelly F-frames in them, so who knows what kind of comb they're building. My hope is in the next 2 days, today and tomorrow, I'll have enough time to go out and level some of those a little bit better, but the damage may be done. It depends on how much comb they've already built. So it's another management thing I'll have to deal with next year when I open them up and go, man, that was really stupid. I had somebody write in and say, I'm such a weird individual, and I agree. I'm in over my head sometimes, and I don't do a good job managing my bees because I don't take the proper amount of time. I always think I'm going to have more time, but I never get more time. And, you know, there's things to do around the house. Yesterday I spent the day cutting up trees that have been down on the property and making firewood and doing all that. Should have done it a lot earlier this year. So, but I love bees and I love doing this stuff. And maybe my haphazard way is just the way I have to do it. This is one example that 15 hives are too many for me because of taking shortcuts. It's not how I want to keep bees, but I've made my bed and I'm going to sleep in it. In time, through some means, it's not evident yet, and I don't want to do it by losses. I think I probably got to get down to 8 to 10 hives at most. I do not, to be clear, want to lose my hives, and I'm hoping that I have 15 in the spring. This problem, or more challenge if I take a politically correct approach to it, is something I'm trying to figure out. So one of the challenges I've come with having so many hives is, what do I put them on? I've been thinking that I would love to find a chimney block. If you're not familiar with them, chimney blocks are square cinder blocks with a hole in the middle. that form the chimney when you stack them on top of each other. And the dimension seems to be good as a base for a hive stand. In fact, I've seen some people who have their hives in photographs on Pinterest on chimney blocks. The problem is, I'm not exactly sure where to buy these. And I should note that while I've designed my own PVC hive stand, I usually put them on blocks that are in the ground and make a platform. That's what I keep talking about when I always say platforms. Incidentally, I recently purchased two metal hive stands from Kelly when I placed the order. They're kind of like angle iron metal hive stands that resemble something like a bed frame in their design. I opened the box the other night, and on first impression, they're okay, but they seem awfully short, like the legs are short. My hive stands make my hives a little higher off the ground, and I think they're the perfect height. I really like how high they are. They're optimal to me. These hive stands would make me bend over more, but they'd be perfect on a chimney block, especially one that you didn't put that far down into the ground. So alas, I don't have any chimney blocks, but one of the things I probably do is go out, put them on something, and I don't even have any spare cinder blocks around, although I think I know where there might be a couple. But one of the things I'll do this weekend is take corrective actions. I don't think it's too late to try and level some of my hives. And by the way, you need to do that for winter. They can't be screwed up, especially ones that are leaning backwards where the water could run into the bottom board. So here's the thing. My thought process over the next 60 days is to monitor my mites, check the hive populations, keep an eye on fall forage. Each of these things are going to impact my strategy of ensuring the four basic tenets: disease-free, queen right, size right, ample stores. Continue to feed the colonies that require building and get my house in order. It's been an odd year here in New Jersey. As I was saying a second ago, it's been unseasonably cool, at least from my recollection. It feels more like fall already than summer. And the little purple flowers along the roadside that I'm used to seeing in fall that are the precursor to goldenrod are bloomed. They've been out 2-3 weeks already, and I saw some goldenrod yesterday while walking along the edge of the field. Did I say winter is coming? The seasons seem a little weird this year. We had an early and routinely wet spring, which means in a good way, rain every once in a while keeps the plants viable for spring, and they worked all through summer. We've had a cool and rainy summer, and one of the things that happens with a wet year is there's a certain plant, jewelweed, that runs in wet areas. I've seen it everywhere this year, everywhere. And earlier this year, I saw just tons and tons and tons of pollen, every hive bringing in gobs of pollen, and I'm pretty confident it's jewelweed. It's bright yellow. And now I'm starting to see the switch of darker orange go in, which I think is goldenrod. So great forage in July and August for pollen to build bees. And they're already on the fall forage, which is coming, which is a good sign. This is going to be an amazing year for bees, I think. While looking out the window of the building at work, I noticed the trees are already starting to show some dappled color of fall coming in, and it's literally the 1st of September. It seems early to me this year. The dearth that we usually see between July and August, I don't think we had that much of it this year. My creek is still running, as I've said in the past. That's a barometer for me. And that's unusual. So let's hope we have a really good fall forage. The sign so far is that we should. And I guess we'll have to wait and see how it turns out. And if anything, I picked a phenomenal year, yes, to ramp up to 15 hives. They've had really good conditions. And with my little supplemental feeding here and there, I'm hoping to have really good colonies going into winter. So we're into September, and this is that time of year where the forlorn who did not take care of their mite problems step in and try and do something. Winter is coming, folks. I hope you and yours have taken the right measures to address any possible varroa mite problems a little earlier than that. At least for the Mid-Atlantic region in New Jersey, this period between Labor Day and Halloween are crucial to whether or not your hives are going to survive come the winter. I guess there's one last week to push for summer. They say it's going to be in the mid-80s next week, and then I think towards mid-September it should start tapering off. But I guess for those procrastinators, it's not too late to try and do something proactive about your summer hive maintenance. This is the time of year where I always assess whether winter is coming, am I prepared or not. And this year I feel optimistically confident, more so than other years. I think I've been better at that, and hopefully you have too. So that's it. It's been a long run, half hour, sorry, running through this, but hope you found it useful. And I'll keep you posted on how things are going over the next couple episodes till we button everything up for the year. Topic number two, Seattle beekeeping scene. Before I start this, Kevin moment. I record these things whenever I can find 5 minutes of spare time, and it's a Tuesday night, and I'm here recording just before I'm going to put this out. And there's a thunderstorm going through. Just rocked the house. Now there's a little bit of a break, and I'm trying to get this in before the next one comes, and I want to make sure we don't lose power. See the extent we go through in this world. End of Kevin moment. I mentioned that we were in Seattle, and during the week, I tried to see if I could hook up with someone to explore the local beekeeping scene. I poked around on the web all week, and I was a little bit disenfranchised, but the day before we were to leave, I made a connection with Krista Connor, who operates Seattle Beeworks. I'd been talking to my son Danny prior to coming out, and discussed with him, is it possible that we might be able to hook up and go to a Puget Sound Beekeepers Association, PSBA, meeting while we were out there. It turns out that we didn't connect on that. The meeting was the week before, a week after, I don't remember the schedule, but it wasn't going to work. And I looked at all the other beekeeping associations within driving distance, and none of them worked. So the timing didn't work out, but the stars were aligned. I had reached out to Krista, and she wrote back saying that the PSBA was participating in an event in West Seattle, and she could make an arrangement for us to connect on the day we were flying out, that Saturday. So Dan and I packed up some gear that I brought, and we took a ride over. We spent some time checking out the digs, and wow, what a unique and amazing resource. Picture a small park with a large community garden running along one street in a Seattle neighborhood. At the end of the garden was this large plexiglass and wooden enclosure structure with hives inside, and it was adorned with different facts about bees and insights for park visitors. The PSBA had some tents set up for this event, and they were conducting an outreach event for children, and they were selling some honey and wares and t-shirts and hats and everything and hosting the games and other activities. So cool. PSBA event. Neat. We met with Krista and took a few minutes to sit down with her and ask some questions about beekeeping in West Seattle. We were under a little time pressure as I had to leave the event at a little after 11, and she was gearing up to present a live or support a live presentation in the bee enclosure. So it wasn't an extensive visit, but I think we covered a number of interesting things about our business and activities going on there. And to keep things simple, let me just play the interview, and then I'll come back with some insights and set up the second person we talked to that morning. So I'm here with Krista Connor. Krista is a West Seattle beekeeper, and you have other activities going on around beekeeping. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're here today at an event. There's a kids event going on across the field from us, and you're here at Puget Sound Beekeepers Association helping with the event, and I want to say thanks first for letting us take a few minutes of your time. And I know we have to hurry because at 11 o'clock sharp, you guys are doing a bee cage demonstration or a bee booth. So tell me a little bit about beekeeping here in West Seattle. How many hives do you have?
So, in overall, I have probably about 20. I lose track every now and then because of swarms and such. And so, give or take 20, and I find that's kind of my personal limit. I do have a unique style of beekeeping in that I don't have them on my own property. I live in a condo, so I've placed them in friends and what are now clients, paying clients, which is an interesting model, to have my beehives on their property for pollination purposes, and we do some honey sharing as a result of that.
So it's urban beekeeping with a slant, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's neat. You sell locally at a couple establishments, and you said you have an arrangement with a restaurant.
Yeah, so my honey, I'm getting ready to do my harvest here in a couple of weeks. I typically harvest in the fall, and so instead of going to farmers markets, which takes a lot of time and energy that I don't necessarily have, so I'll sell wholesale to the local market, so Husky Deli here in West Seattle, which is kind of an institution. And then another little produce stand, and then the Edgewater Hotel, which is quite famous downtown on the water. They use my honey on their buffet and on one of their salmon dishes.
Oh, nice.
That's really neat.
Do you mentor?
I do. Yeah, so through the course of my beekeeping and scaling up from starting with two hives up to the 20, I realized doing it solo was lonely. And I learned, through engagement with the homeowners that had my hives on their property, that's like there's really a thirst for learning about bees, and it was really exciting to me to share the experience and to teach others. And so I took on some interns, I've created a formal program for training, so a season-long effort that someone could participate in, and they could get a taste for beekeeping and not have to have that big investment, because it's like, there's a lot of money and time to sink into it.
You work with a college, did I see on your website, or at least do some interactions with some of them around here, helping them out?
Yeah, so local community college, one of their professors, he was involved with my program initially, and so it was awesome. He was an entomologist, and having him engage with our program was awesome for that particular year's students. And then I also offer some non-credit credits for through the WSU growing program.
Oh, that's great. What a resource to have available to you.
Yeah.
What type of hives do you keep? Langstroth?
So I do Langstroth, 10 frame. If I had a do-over, I might do the 8-frame, the weight. But after investing in 20 hives worth of gear, it's like, well, where do you start over?
You ever consider all mediums?
I do all mediums. The only time I had shifted over to the deeps was when I did the doing nukes. And so when you get the deep frames, it's like, well, what am I going to do now? So it's like, okay, got to shift a little there.
Tell me about your beekeeping season. When does it start and how long does it run?
Yes.
What's the type of forage you might see here?
So in the Pacific Northwest, our beekeeping season, we have typically it starts and packages get delivered April, May, and they come up from California. And our springs are really long and rainy, so it's a really tough time, one, if you've overwintered bees, to keep them alive. People think, oh, I made it through winter.
Yeah.
But then they'll die in April.
Then you got to get, that's got to be tough.
Oh, my gosh. So really got to watch to make sure that they have enough food, artificial feeding or, access to forage in that spring time frame. So April, May start time, and we'll run into, August is when we need to really be doing our harvest and treating for mites. And that was a benefit of our entomologist. He did a research study, and he said, if you're going to be treating for mites, you got to start in August, no later than that. And so August, you're in their hives through September. October, our rains start, and so you got to have your hives winterized.
Close down in October time frame.
And our main nectar source is Himalayan blackberry.
Oh, yeah?
Which is technically a noxious.
I see blackberry for sale everywhere, but that didn't know what that was.
It's a plentiful nectar source. Unfortunately, in the state of Washington, it's a noxious weed.
Oh, is it?
So I'm like, just leave it for the bees, and then you can tear it out after it blooms, And then late season, we'll get knotweed, which is also a noxious weed.
Right, yes.
And then fireweed, people take their hives to the mountains. You'll get some fireweed there. So, and then early spring, if you have overwintered hives, maple trees and basswood trees.
Fireweed is a different taste, or is it pretty conventional?
To me, it's very sweet, and it's a light, very light colored, and kind of front of the tongue, tasting sweet, not super complex. The blackberry, to me, it's a medium amber, and sometimes it runs into knotweed, so you'll get a darker amber, and it's more complex and more interesting to me.
We bought some to bring home to New Jersey.
I should have brought you some, yeah.
No, it's okay. So listen, I know you have to get going. What else didn't I ask you that I should have asked you about what goes on? Tell me about, we were talking with Kevin, who's the president. 185 members you have in Puget Sound?
Yeah, so Puget Sound Beekeepers is an awesome organization. I'm a past president. I have close to 300 members.
Wow.
So it's pretty awesome in terms of, it's also amazing. It's like we have that many beekeepers.
How big is your coverage area?
So it's Puget Sound. We'll go, and so there's different local organizations, so up to Snohomish, and then Pierce County, which is like Tacoma area.
Okay.
And
yeah, that's pretty big territory.
Sound. Yeah. Yeah. So it's pretty big, but people kind of meander between different.
Do you know the website address?
PugetSoundBees.org.
And how about your address for your website?
SeattleBeeWorks.com.
Seattle BeeWorks. And you sell at local places, but you don't have a storefront. But if people wanted to get a hold of you?
So they can email me, Krista, at SeattleBeeWorks.com. I'm on Instagram and Facebook. I don't ship honey, because I want to drive people to their local beekeepers.
Right.
And so that's kind of, I don't even ship it to my own mom.
Uh-oh.
So I'm like, you got to come out here and visit to get honey, because I think it really highlights that local connection. It's really important to me that people understand that.
Okay, well, I promised I'd get you done on time, so we'll let you go do your demo. Maybe we'll film that for a couple of minutes, and I wanted to say thanks for spending time with us today.
Glad you're out here. Thanks.
I know the audio in that was a little bit rough. You know, when you're live in the field, you get what you get. I packed light and didn't think to bring a wind muff, so the wind noise was a little rough. But I think it turned out well enough. Maybe it wasn't clear, but at one point a child playing on the playground nearby took a dive and it sounded like a murder in the background. But that's live interviews for you. I filtered it out as best I could, and hopefully you couldn't tell, but that's how it goes. Interesting, isn't it, the way she has her hives placed with someone else and has found different niches to round out her business? Seattle BeeWorks is the name, and you could find her on the web at the address she shared, Facebook, Instagram, so she's pretty proactive in that way. I so appreciate that she took the time to answer the email from a stranger and make that connection for me. So speaking of email, I was told by Krista to seek out Laura England when she replied, and during the morning we found her, and I had a short sit-down about the bee garden with her. Let me play the conversation we had, and then I'll come back and talk a little bit more about my interaction with her and the officers and members of the PSBA that morning. So I'm here with Laura England?
Yes.
Great name. Love that last name. We're here at the West Seattle Bee Garden, and I've been walking around looking at what is here, and you're the creator of this.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about this place? Just describe it for those who are listening.
Yeah, well, so the West Seattle Bee Garden is part of the Commons Park Pea Patch here in the High Point neighborhood of West Seattle. And what we did was we expanded the pea patch to include a pollination garden and the bee enclosure, which houses four different beehives.
Uh-huh.
And the enclosure also has educational signs on it that talks about bees and pollination and beekeeping in general and different pollinators. So families can come, or people can come whenever they want, and explore the garden and read the signs and watch the bees coming and going from the hives. And they can explore the pollination garden and read the signs about the different plants. But then we also have these special events here, like we're having today, the PSBA Kids Field Day.
Puget Sound Beekeepers Association.
Mm-hmm, yep. So on days like today, we have Natalie, the children's librarian. She works at the library just a couple blocks away from here, and she does story time. And then we do hive demonstrations where I'll go in there and talk to a group of people about how the hive works and about about honeybees, but we also try to talk about all of the pollinators and what pollination is. And then I'll go inside the enclosure and open the hives. And since the walls of the enclosure are primarily plexiglass, the people can watch me open the hives, and they can see, I can hold the frames right up next to the plexiglass, and they can see the pollen and the honey and the larva and all the different parts of the inside of a hive from the safety of, you know, from being outside of the enclosure. Right. And then today, prior to field day, we have a bunch of different booths. So we have honey tasting and an observation hive. We have arts and crafts, and kids can make flowers. We've got the bee anatomy game and a flower facts game and pollination simulation and a plant identification scavenger hunt.
Do you do this every year? Or?
Yeah, this is our third year.
Nice. Another
big event that we have here every year is the West Seattle Bee Festival.
Uh-huh.
And that started in 2013, and that was in celebration of opening this space. So
you built the enclosure in 2013?
Yeah, we started in 2012. We started the process of it, and it all kind of started with a blog post.
Yeah.
Posted the idea of having an educational space with bees, and put that on the West Seattle blog, and I got 100 email responses in 10 days.
Wow.
From the community. Heard from people at the West Seattle Elementary School who offered to help write the grant. We heard from people who helped with the educational signs and building the enclosure, just with every step of the way. You know, even, you know, people heard that we needed wood benches and a local tree fell down, and we were able to use the wood from the tree to build the benches.
Nice.
So just kind of everyone came together in a really amazing way, and that's how it happened.
Yeah, it's just an amazing, I mean, as you look around, there's people gardening. I saw somebody watering plants before, and we have the kids in the back getting their education right now, and
bees buzzing around us and all of
bees are buzzing all around
seasons.
Us. I was shooting pictures of pollinators on the plants before.
The rest of the pea patch, these are all individual plots that are managed by individual gardeners who live here in the neighborhood.
Okay.
And this High Point neighborhood has a very diverse population. We have refugees from Cambodia, Vietnam, and Somalia. So you'll see some of the print on the signs is in all of those languages. And a lot of our gardeners here are from those countries.
Oh, neat. Yeah. So who maintains these hives?
I do.
You do?
Yeah, with the help of some people, but me primarily. And we do a lot of field trips with school groups. About 35 classrooms will come through every year.
Yeah.
And we do field trips with them.
Well, this is an amazing resource. I want to say thanks for taking us through it today. And I'll have some pictures to support what we talked about. And thanks for all that you do. This is great.
Yeah, thanks for coming by. It's nice meeting you guys.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the descriptions gave enough justice to the resource that these people have available to them in their community. What a cool outreach mechanism that this group has put together. We got to speak to Lauren and walked around the enclosure and took pictures of everything, and I intend to bring some of them back and show them to the New Jersey beekeeping community. You know, what's neat is that the top of the enclosure is open. The bees are flying up from the hives and out, and they're right over the general public. There was a whole field full of kids there, and nobody was the wiser, and they opened the hives inside and had plenty of room. It's a plexiglass and wood enclosure, and in the back there's a little room for the equipment for them to maintain the enclosure and monitor the bees. It's really neat. So we took a moment to also talk to some of the members of the Puget Sound Beekeepers Association. They were maintaining a number of tents set up there for kid activities, and I bumped into Kevin, as you heard earlier. He's the president of the Beekeepers Association. How ironic is that? And we talked to a couple of their members, and their beekeeping year is pretty similar to ours. Their activities are pretty similar to ours. They certainly have a different landscape. We don't have a major metropolitan city in the middle of our sending district, but and their area is huge. At one point, they had said something about Sonomish. We went up there during the travels, and it's pretty far, so yeah, neat visit, definitely worth it, and I'm glad we got to squeeze that in. All right, enough gushing about that. One other thing. If you want to see what it looks like, this is pretty easy. Visit the website of westseattlebeegarden.com. There you could see a picture of the enclosure. You could see the blueprints of the plan. You could see the photos from when they built it. And all the other things, including BeeFest. She alluded to that. It looks like it's a really huge deal with a bunch of different vendors. So when they do public outreach, they're doing it in a big way. Good for them. Okay, moving on. Let's go ahead and go to roundtables. Roundtable number one, what were they thinking? I thought about diving into the beekeeping regulations proposed by the New Jersey Department of Agriculture when discussing the topic, but as I think about it, it doesn't make sense to dredge that up. You see, the NJDA decided to pull the proposal, and they're reconsidering the matter. A statement on their website indicates that they have recalled the proposal legislation for additional discussion based on comments received thus far. Speaking of comments received thus far, you know, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore kind of person when it comes to writing things in. And certainly if I were ever going to write someone, I would do the newspaper test. What would you think if somebody posted this about you in the newspaper? But in this case, I was mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I sent in a pretty scathing letter as I think back of it, and I'm not embarrassed by it. I don't know if I ever stood face to face with the people I wrote to, how I would feel about it. But you know what? They deserve to be poked in the chest. The legislation was absurd. It was ridiculous. It was so far off for professional legislators, for professional people, to what should be done in the state. They should be embarrassed. And I couldn't help myself but let them know that. And that was a little bit of where it was, that the name-calling part of it. But I think you could line 15 beekeepers up, and all 15 in this case would be unanimous about how terrible what they wrote was. So if you're not familiar with the topic, the Reader's Digest version is that the New Jersey Beekeepers Association worked with legislators to drive control of beekeeping ordinances to the state level for consistency and fairness. And the New Jersey Department of Agriculture proposed something that looks so constrictive for beekeeping that it's not melodramatic to say that it would have had a serious chance of collapsing the way we do beekeeping in the state. And there was feedback allowed from participants, from the public, and they put the crying towel out about how bad it was and allergic and this and that and their victims and so on. And it must have been blood-sucking lawyers who empathized with that viewpoint, because that's the way the thing was written. It was just absurd. So this whole thing blew up just before we went to EAS. And I remember going to EAS, and people from other states, when hearing that I was from New Jersey, asked me what the heck it was about this legislation. One had informed me that they had an emergency meeting with their beekeepers association and contact state legislators that they knew, explaining to them that this legislation was being proposed by New Jersey and not to ever, never consider it. That's how egregious this was, that it made other states, even in draft form, stand up and take notice. So hopefully the bell was rung, you know, and that these folks got the message. I would like to think that they will engage and come back with a fair, reasonable approach and not place absurd constraints. But we in New Jersey, as it should be until it's finished, are a bit apprehensive about what comes next. At the core of it, the thing we took issue with, at least me personally, was two hives on a property smaller than 5 acres was simply too restrictive. In essence, they took a concept of least threat to non-beekeepers and engineered a really conservative approach and then pretty much applied it to every land use in the state. Dumb, 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 dumb. It didn't reflect the realities of land use diversity in New Jersey. In some neighborhoods, yes, you can stand in your kitchen and there's an alleyway between the homes. You could wave at your neighbor standing in their kitchen while you're washing your dishes in your kitchen, and they can see you're washing your pots and pans. On that property, two hives is about all it should stand. But there are certainly a large number of postage-sized lots in the state that require that approach, and there's also, in other municipality properties, 1, 2, 5, 10, 100, 200-acre lots. And two hives for them is ridiculous. There are New Jersey homeowners who own secluded lots where they can't see their neighbors' homes. So restricting them to two hives is simply absurd. And yes, it was about protecting non-beekeepers, but come on. Come on. So hopefully they're sharpening their pencils and they have to go back to the drawing board. And at minimum, I think they realize that we, New Jersey beekeepers, are going to protect our interests and be active participants in our outcomes. Do I regret sending the messages and the tones? Yeah, a little bit. It's not something I want published in the paper, but you know what? If I had that posted, 15 beekeepers would stand behind me and say I wrote the right message. A message needed to be sent. And the fact that it got pulled prior to even being reviewed means they got it, which was the reason the messages were sent. So don't be afraid. You know, look, I see these campaigns all the time. You got to send a message to write your legislator. Sometimes I agree with it and sometimes I don't. Sometimes I think what's being written is not so bad and it could be tweaked and worked out through negotiation. And they really don't read these messages. But in this case, yeah, a message needed to be sent and it was read and it was received. So, what were they thinking? Roundtable number 2, Master Beekeepers, follow-up. I came away with what I deserved, 2 tests down, 2 to go. For those that don't know what I'm talking about, I decided this year to see if I could pass the EAS Master Beekeepers test. Went through the program when I attended in Newark, Delaware. I got through the oral and practical exams, and we'll have to retake the written in the labs. You need an 85 to pass, and I got a 74 on both of those. I kind of had a suspicion going in that it might turn out that way. As you know what you know. In my case, I was weak on pollination, plant, and a few other aspects of beekeeping, and that's mostly what I got wrong. I studied the things that I had a passion in, and wanted to know more about anatomy and so on. But when it comes to the rest of it, it was just too much to study and cram in the time frame that I left available to myself. On the labs, I was wholly unprepared due to a major oversight on my part. I didn't study whatsoever for the labs, and it was a mystery going in. In my haste of last-minuteness, I discovered that I simply missed the study advice on the website of what was going to be on that test. If I had known that I missed it, I think I probably would have gotten through that. I took the lab test by walking in the room with a score sheet and finding what was in front of me and gave it the old college try. I know I didn't do great, and the night after taking it, I went back in and logged into the EAS website and found the place that told you how to prepare for it. Yeah, duh. I totally missed it. I didn't even know it was out there. I was walking around asking other beekeepers, like, what is this lab about? Do you know what the test is? How does it work? And it was examples with previous test questions and things like that out on the website. And, yeah, I didn't even know. Truth be told, I gave every spare waking moment I had studying for what I studied for, and probably would have half-studied that section too, so I'm not disappointed. I'm looking forward to have the proper amount of time to go even further in my mastery of topics going into July of next year, and I have the attitude that I'm going to apply myself and kill it in Virginia. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. I have one other advantage. Klaus has caved. He's been rethinking his ban on taking the Master Beekeepers and informed me that he'll throw his hat in the ring. I feel like Buzz Lightyear from Toy Story. I found my stud, buddy. I don't mind studying alone, but I know the advantages of having one other person to bounce things off of and clarify muddy topics that you're somewhat unclear. And I've studied in the past for project management professional and other certifications, and I know that it's better to do it with two people because it fills in your gap where you're soft and the other person can kind of explain things to you that didn't grasp. You know, there's something about not understanding a topic, and you can't explain it to yourself to fix that. You'd need somebody else. That's what going to school kind of helps you with, as far as I was always concerned. So one final impression is the value of it. I keep getting asked this question after, like, is it really worth it? Why? Why, some ask? What's the point? I truly believe it's about the journey and not the title. But in the end, the title does mean something. The subject matter is so, so diverse. And all the subject matter is in scope for all four of the exams. It forces you to put aside your reservations and dive in for a mastery of the subject. I'll never pass myself off as a master, but on the other hand, I do consider myself more informed because of this podcast and the amount of energy expended over the years in exploring topics for presentation. There's a difference, though, about this that I rather enjoy, which is the studying part, especially when it came to the systems of the bees and the other larger views of things. I cover topics and articles and interests, but they are, in the end, a bit disjointed and disorganized. My study guides have given me, they've allowed me to explore the topics in a more cohesive manner and make the connections of the disparate parts of my learning. It's a little bit odd of a notion, but I can appreciate the nuance of the push and pull of different systems as you think about how they work. I've made a lot of connections. I don't need to be a master beekeeper to know the benefit that in allowing me to understand what I'm looking at and be a better beekeeper, which in the end is really what it's all about. As I studied for different things in this podcast, I studied it for presentation, not for learning. And I've learned a lot of things that I've made a lot of connections over the way, but this is different. It's more cohesive all the way through. Yeah, titles are for nameplates and business cards, but sometimes they can, and in this case I've come to believe, stand for something. And those I can now appreciate who have master beekeepers, yeah, they passed the test. Good for them, right? And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. It's a challenge and a reward. But what they had to do to get there, that's what really matters and why I have due respect for master beekeepers. Roundtable number 3, garage projects. Part of what's been keeping me from being behind the microphone, besides work overload and vacation, is that I've been trying to advance the cause. I've been feeding the Waray hive with a Boardman feeder, but it simply isn't going fast enough. This past week, I built a custom Miller-style feeder out of spare wood and plan to deploy it this weekend. I have 2 of 3 Waray boxes full with bees. They're chock full and can't build anymore. And I'm going to make a push before October 31st for the bees to build out the 3rd box. I hope it's not a fool's errand, but we'll see if the bee gods are favorable in the quest. One of the things that will help is more food, and now I have a mechanism to get it faster. When you work in a Waray hive, you're supposed to nader the boxes, meaning put them underneath the hive that exists, and that's what I did. A lot of people who have Waray hives use a tool, some sort of crank thing that lifts the hives. I don't have anything that fancy, but the boxes that I have seem to be really small, and I don't know why people just don't lift them off. I know, it's disruptive. I took the top cover off. I took the quilt box off. I picked up the 2 boxes and set them down on the ground. I put the new box on the stand, and I put the 2 up. It took 30 seconds. I don't think it was that disruptive because I didn't break the 2 boxes apart. What was more disruptive is the way that I had the entrance on the hive. I had it open on the left side, and I slid it and made the entrance in the middle, and the bees all piled up on the left side before they figured out to walk over and go through the entrance in the middle. I checked on the hive later after I looked at it, and they were all making entrance into the hive, and everything looked back to normal. So we'll see. I put a lot of food on it. The food box that I built has enough for a gallon plus in there. One of the interesting things was melting wax and getting it to go in. I had all kinds of visions of how I was going to do that. And eventually what I ended up doing was taking this really long paintbrush with a small dabber and melted wax in my double boiler and just dribbled it through the cracks. And I got it 99% sealed. I took it and put it in the sink and poured water in it. And this one spot leaked a little bit. So from the outside, I sealed the seam with wax, and I think I got it. When I poured the liquid, the sugar solution, in the box and stood and looked at the hive, and when I went back to it later, it wasn't leaking. So I think I got it. Pretty good. Built a Miller box. Never did that before. Another thing that I'm most of the way through is building a solar wax melter. I lost a little one that I had made out of styrofoam this past spring. It got hit by a car because I had it sitting in the driveway. Broke the lid off the top of it. This styrofoam one was a temporary one at best, and I've always wanted one that was a little more substantial and permanent. I did buy a styrofoam cooler recently and plan to rebuild a replacement for the small one. For small wax melting jobs, but the big one I wanted to use had an old window that I found alongside the road one day, and it's been squirreled away in one of the corners in the garage for a while. And I had visions of building maybe a top bar with a view window, but I changed its purpose to be the top of larger, more permanent solar wax melter because I thought the window was too big to be the side of a top bar. I built out the box and had the top mounted. And I built the shelf for the wax to sit in. And in the collector, I'm just simply going to put a large chafing tray. I made it the perfect size. And the way the box works is you tilt it up at about a 30-degree angle. You set all the wax on a metal pan. And the heat from the sun just lets it drip through a screen that I put in, and it drips in. I just spoke about the other device that I built with wax. I melted some wax yesterday in the driveway and then allowed it to collect and use that to seal the box. So I've already made use of my wax. How cool is that? The box isn't perfect. I didn't paint it yet. It's still rough, but I put it out in the driveway to see whether it would work or not, and it started to melt the wax right away. So awesome. And what's neat about this method is you lay the wax out on the tray, and all the debris sticks to the tray, and the wax itself runs off in liquid form and drips, and it seems to be a lot cleaner than the old one where I was filtering it through paper towels. So I want to build some sort of leg system to get it up off the ground, get it at the right angle. Right now I have it plopped up on a couple 2x4s or 4x4s in the driveway, just to see whether it got hot enough. And it needs to be painted, but, you know, that's a project that is ongoing. So prior to vacation, I ordered some additional equipment. I decided to change vendors. I'd been using Brushy Mountain equipment exclusively, but this time we ordered Kelly. What drove me is the change in frame design. I had Kelly F-frames all over the place, and I wanted a frame with no grooves on the bottom or top surface. I ended up with Kelly as the right configuration that I was looking for. The bottom bar is really substantial, and the bottom of it is flat smooth. And actually what I found is the top bar seemed to be more substantial instead of the side bar. So from a frame construction standpoint, they're really beefy. I've come to the conclusion that grooves on frames encourage inadvertent bridge comb. And I find occasionally that I can't get the top box off the bottom box without having to deal with frames attached to the lower frames below them, because they built in that groove bridge comb down to the frame below it. The culprit that I've found is the brushy style frame that I've been using. It has a grooved bottom bar, which I thought would be neat to slide everything through. You know, sometimes when you put foundation in a frame, it's not, the foundation depth is different. It's not an exact science. And if it's a little too long, you get that little cup, the curve. And in this case, I thought open would be good because it would allow the flexibility of the different lengths. I was hoping that the Kelly sheets of foundation would be consistent since they have to fit in a design space. And for the most part, I found that to be the case. Occasionally here and there, I found one that was a little bit longer. I was really fastidious when putting together frames to make sure that the foundation was flat and that the frames were the right length. And a couple of them, I found that little bit of a cup, but 99% of them, they were pretty good. So the groove bottom bar, nope, won't do that anymore. Truth be told, I also like the aesthetic of the Kelly handhold and their boxes and decided to give it a try. And I've been building boxes and frames, and I have to say the Kelly top bar, sidebar, and bottom bar combination is better. Sorry, Brushy. All around, I'm liking the adjustment so far. Let's hope that I won't have to play the frame game, and that when the inevitable mix of Kelly and Brushy equipment occurs, I don't run into complexity of B-space inconsistencies by using equipment sourced by different vendors. The final thing to review are some metal hive stands that I ordered from the Kelly catalog. I haven't had the time to go collect PVC and work and build a couple of those stands, so I thought I'd try these. I've always thought this design would be easy, just a couple angle iron style pieces with some legs. I have mixed reviews. One word, chintzy. They're engineered enough to hold hives, but I would have preferred them to be more substantial. Kevin Moman, I always wanted to learn to weld. I figured it would open up a new world of opportunities for me. A welder and some angle iron? End of Kevin Moment. I could imagine building a wood fire, charcoal grill, and angle iron metal hives, but alas, I will have to settle on PVC until I can get to that chapter in my life where I buy a welder and practice and learn to weld. But even scabby welds would work when you get to an angle iron stand, wouldn't you think? The other impression of these stands is that they are just short in stature. Even if you put them on a brick or better yet a cement block, the legs are really short. Couldn't they afford to be a little higher? They're so much shorter when compared to the hive stands that I built, which I think are the right height. Why? Why didn't they just make them a smidge longer? It seems odd to me. I'll figure out a plan to put them out, put hives on them. But they're going to have to go on a cinder block, and what's the point? If I'm going to put them on cinder blocks, just put the hives on cinder blocks. I keep experimenting, so on experience, I'm pretty clear that I won't be ordering more of these. I'm going to learn to weld and make my own to-do list for this winter. Check. I guess I could stand to describe what they were. To me, they had an angle iron, meaning a V-shape, 90 degree. And then they had one of them had a tab that stuck out with a metal slot. And they come with these little metal braces that go between them. You screw one side, you screw the other side, and that's what connects them. I think if those braces had been more substantial, it would have been even better. But even when they're connected, the sides feel cheap and not so good. If they spent just a little, I would pay $40 for one of these if they made it out of better metal. All right, enough on that. Roundtable number 4, Fairs and Schuler. The fairs of 2017 have come and gone. My summer schedule had me away for EAS and then a family vacation. And I wasn't there for the major operation days of the fairs this year. I did, however, get to one long-standing arrangement to capture a feature on honey judging with state apiarist Tim Schuler. He and I have been discussing this for several seasons at the notion of recording a behind-the-scenes operation of a honey show. The first day of the fair fell on a Wednesday, which is in the middle of the work week, so I had to take a day off. But I have days that if I don't take them, I'm going to lose them, so I brought my gear to the Hunterdon Fair to capture timid work. He had Northwest New Jersey beekeeper Alice Casey sitting in on the judging this year as a helper, and I filmed various goings-on as he judged this year's show. I will say it was a disappointment that there were not a lot of entries, probably the fewest I've seen at our Hunterdon show, which is usually a showcase, but there was enough to judge to get by and get the fundamentals of how to judge a show in the footage. I have a number of video clips recorded that I'll have to weave together in the production. And I think it'll be a great compliment to the Warren County meeting I shot earlier this year where Tim talked about preparing for the show. I feel a sense of pride and duty that some of these things are being captured and will be out there for a long time for people to see. And I'm really happy that I've had the opportunity to do this in the invite from Tim. My productions are not Discovery Channel quality, but they're an adequate capture, and there's little like them out on the web. I can only imagine that had there been someone to follow, someone like George Emery, or heck, even Reverend Langstroth and Von Frisch, what a different world we'd be in. All the stuff that they knew that never got on tape or in a book or recorded must be amazing. So I feel fortunate that I get to do my part to convey the information, and hopefully people will benefit from it. On another note about the fairs, it was rewarding to see the bee cage or bee enclosure in use. This is the one that I spoke of in a number of episodes that was under construction last year, last winter. It turned out well, and yeah, there's a couple few punch list items of improvements, but it served its purpose, and it seemed an improvement, or at least equal to the one that we had prior. One of the key things was ease of setup. I didn't set it up or take it down either time, but what people said was that it was easy. The parts and pieces were lightweight, which was one of the key requirements. And in the Hunterdon County Fair, it sounds like two young men, juveniles, set it up for the most part, which is pretty cool. We wanted it lightweight and quick to assemble on both setups. It was said that it was, so mission accomplished. Does a body good to hear that it worked out. Congrats to the team, and major kudos to Jim Smalls, who was the anchor to facilitating the build, and for his heavy lifting on the major components of the build, his workshop. He sourced all the materials. He certainly deserves most of the credit for the work done to build it. As it is customary with me, and I think I said, I tried to document the process. I'm not sure if I have a ton of material, but I think I have enough to write up the experience. And I was hoping of making it a feature to submit to Bee Culture or ABJ. All I need is a little time to gather it up and produce it. You know, if I can only quit my real job and go into the life of journalism of beekeeping. Note to self, work out the business plan. Roundtable number 5, up close and personal. I talked about the bee gym in a previous episode. Lo and behold, I saw one at a vendor booth in EAS, so I bought one. It wasn't cheap at $20, but for a science, I'm going to give it a try. I had a thought that I might put it in one of my hives and set up the GoPro on a tripod to record the bees' reaction to it and see how it works. I spoke of this device in episode 110, but I never saw a real one, and now I have one and we'll see how it works out. Along the lines of things at EAS, I had a notion to see if I can get an oxalic vaporizer, and I purchased one of those too. These were a little expensive to my line of thinking, and I wished I could have found the time to build one, as they're not that complicated, and I don't see it as hard to construct. Time, though, is the enemy of all busy people, so in this case I simply decided to buy one. I did manage to save some money by buying a slightly used one. I'm sure the bees won't care of the aesthetics if it looks a little tarnished, and while being me, type A that I am, I probably will clean it up before I use it. Of course, I simply want it to work. and it requires power. So as for feeding it, I have a little portable battery that can jump your car. You know, one of those little case batteries with a handle on it that you can use to power your radio at a picnic outing type thing. And I'm hopes that it will suffice and operate the thing, but there is a plan B. Rich from Broodminder. I'm pretty sure it was Rich who came up with the tip, so I'm going to give him credit. Said use a lawn tractor battery. Yeah, drive your lawn tractor out to your hives and hook the device up to that. How is that for brilliant? I'll get familiar with its use, and when I fire up, I'll give a report of how I make out with it. So speaking of cool tips, I got one more to throw at you here. I may have mentioned this before, but I keep a cache of old Arizona iced tea containers to feed with, the gallon jugs. I find that they're easy to work with, they have a nice handle, and they stack really well, and they're pretty darn sturdy. Over time, sugar water containers get a little mold growing them, and while it doesn't hurt the bees, it's kind of gross and off-putting for me. Anal as I am, I find myself with a bottle scrubber, or occasionally I buy a gallon of iced tea and replace the dirty bottles. I mentioned this in passing to someone, and they said, you know, if you took some sand and shook it around on the inside, it would clean up the container lickety-split. Darn, that is so smart. What a cool and simple tip. As it's not a picnic to clean these jars out with a darn bottle brush, it's really a pain, especially if you're fastidious like I am. I forgot who told me that, but if you're listening, thank you. Thank you and thank you. Roundtable number 6, production value. This is, I guess, the last topic, maybe. I'm running to the bottom of the pile and running a little late, so I've come to understand the value of making this podcast in my quest to learn more about production of audio and video features. Sound, video, and such. What a pain. On those broadcast recordings from Seattle, I realized that my Zoom recorder that I used has a gain button, and it's set to low, medium, and high, and somehow in the case it got switched to low, and the audio was just terrible, and then the wind noise, and it seems like I'm constantly in the pursuit of trying to figure out how to do these recordings well. I wanted to offer up that I found something in the podcast editor's toolbox from a Facebook thing that I'm on called Auphonic, Auphonic. When I first listened to those recordings of Lauren and Krista, they were horrible. They were so low you couldn't hardly make it. There's an automated tool, the one I just mentioned, and it saved those recordings. I put it through and it cleaned them all up. There's a certain amount of time you get if you put your audio recording through that you could do for free for the processing, and then you could pay to subscribe. And I think what I likely will do going forward is use, I don't get a ton of donations, but what I do get, I always pour back into the podcast, and I think I might go forward in the future and pour my finished product into Auphonic and have them level it out, and it'll fix a lot of the ills, for I am certainly not a sound editor. So I've had a lot of fun lately trying to make videos. I'm always doing videos and audio, and yes, I've been away, but I have a lot of recordings to post, and I think when things slow down in the fall and we get into the dearth, I'll be putting things out. To that end, if you go to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/bkcorner or youtube.com/nwnjba, you'll see I posted a couple recordings here or there. Given I'm going long, I won't belabor, but if you wanted to see something new, there's a couple up there if you haven't checked in a while. All right. righty. I think that about wraps it up. As I'm closing down this episode, I start to look at the news about Irma coming to the United States, heading into Puerto Rico as we speak. Wow, what a scary, magnificent storm this is. Wicked. It's a monstrosity. I have family down in Tampa, and I'm hoping that it's not going to be as bad. But right now, it just seems inevitable. Makes us turn and look at what happened in Texas. I posted a post of the hurricane over top of B County, Texas, and Beeville during that storm. Lauren Bruns, one of our regular listeners, wrote in that located right near there. And I hope Lauren is making out okay. And for all you folks down there in Florida, our thoughts are with you. As I think about it, I was going to bed last night thinking, it's going to come through the United States. Early forecast showing it taking a loop and coming up through South Carolina, North Carolina. But who knows, it could be hugging the coast. And thinking to myself, with 130 to 180 mile an hour winds, how would you secure your hives? What would you do? My notion is maybe you take a really strong tent post or angle iron or something and put it in front, behind, side to side, and run straps over in a web over top, because I think a cinder block on top of the hive is not going to keep it from blowing over. Yeah, so that's an interesting notion, and who knows, in a week from now, this thing may blow through New Jersey and we'll have to figure that out. Certainly those folks down there in Tampa and or Florida, Miami area are thinking about this right now, but life and safety first, folks. That's, I guess, the way you have to set the priorities. So scary, scary storm going on there. The Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers has a September meeting tentatively scheduled for September 16th. Going to see where that ends up, but I'm away that day with my son Brian. We're doing something. The state meeting hosted by the New Jersey Beekeepers Association is September 30th at the Sparta High School in Sussex. I think in my recollection, this is the first meeting in Sussex that I can recall. So that's kind of cool. Never been up to that part of the state for a beekeepers meeting. And you see a trickle of Sussex people come down to Middle and South, but you hardly see them in mass. I always wonder what beekeeping is like up there in that corner of the state. So we're going to sit front and center amongst hopefully a whole plethora of Sussex County beekeepers and get the vibe there. So I'm looking forward to that. That should be pretty cool. As I end up the episode, I start to think about the theme, winter is coming. It means a couple things to me, but literally, winter is coming. It was warm today in the 80s, and as I'm recording this, it's Tuesday night, September 5th at 8:25 p.m., and like I said, a storm ran through. We dodged it for the second half, but it's been pretty warm, and yeah, we'll see. I have a lot of work to do to get buttoned up for winter. I think I'm a little risky at trying to build out comb and do things this time of year, but I am going to rub the belly of the bee god Buddha and see if we can get things going. So all right, with that, thanks for listening, everybody. If you want to reach out to me, kevin@bkcorner.org. Let me know who you are, where you're writing from. Visit our website, bkcorner.org, and we'll catch you next time. Like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks for listening, and be well.